Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
About 24,000 children will be diagnosed with autism this year, and sometimes it's less about the child than it is about the parents and their ability to cope with a disorder.
The parents of autistic children often stick together, and we have to.
They have no idea how easy it is compared to this. And all, your heart is breaking all day long. You know, you think about his future and all the pain he's in, and I don't think they can understand that.
Voices of parents from the film Autism Every Day talk about the exhaustion and the frustration and the heartbreak that comes with having an autistic child. There's a lot of information out there about autism. Not all of it is true. We've got the straight facts for you about autism and what works to treat it. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 15th, President's Day. Happy holiday. And I am joined here by Todd Zwillick today, or filling in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Celeste.
Takeaway for me, of course, is that with any disorder, with any medical condition, there's going to be some disagreement. It's going to be confusing.
Plenty. And with autism and autism spectrum disorder, it's so broad and so complicated, it only adds to the confusion. We're going to try to cut through some of that later in the show. But here's a look at some of the headlines we're following this morning. Here's the sound of U.S. troops during day three of the offensive in Marja.
Clear as many compounds as possible and push up.
Right next to it, on the side.
Which side? Right side, left
side. Side wall, right.
You're listening to the sound of United States Marine and Afghan units. Now they've cleared most of the city. They have most of it under control, but there are pockets of the city where fighting is still going on. The BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner is at NATO headquarters in nearby Kandahar. He says the main problem is the thousands of mines and IEDs the Taliban has hidden throughout Marja.
Taliban insurgents have planted even greater numbers than predicted, slowing the advance of U.S. forces in the area around Marja. Those insurgents that have chosen to stay and fight are believed to be concentrated in Marja. The assessment of NATO intelligence officers is that insurgent resistance to Operation Mushtarak is disjointed and in pockets. They believe the Taliban may be holding off from launching attacks for the next few days while they wait to see if NATO and its Afghan government allies are staying or leaving.
Now, the Pentagon says that the Taliban's use of IEDs has more than doubled from a year ago. And this morning, we're learning a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind.
The ones who are still remaining in the area, some of them have chosen to fight. Today, our message to them is, your best option is to take advantage of the Afghan peace and reconciliation program.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is drifting toward a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government.
Those enterprises controlled by the Revolutionary Guard, which we believe is in effect supplanting the government of Iran.
At the Winter Olympics, Canada's long cold streak finally over. Alexander Bilodeau took home the gold in the moguls, winning the country's first ever Olympic gold on their home turf.
There will be more gold winning, and I'll be in the stand cheer for them.
So far, the U.S. leads the medal count with six. They're followed by Germany and France. And best-selling British author Dick Francis has died at his home in the Cayman Islands. He was 89 years old. He wrote 42 novels about horse racing after ending his career as a jockey. Looking at the markets, Asian markets down, European indices are up, Wall Street markets closed for President's Day. Coming up in the show, as we said earlier, health studies often contradict each other. And if your child has autism, you may be confused by the information that's out there. We're going to try and get you straight information later this hour.
We're also following the Olympics. It's pretty amazing that that was Canada's first gold medal on its home turf, considering they've had the Olympics twice before. But we're following the Olympics and asking whether they've gotten too dangerous, too fast, or too extreme. We're looking for your takeaway at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to mytake at thetakeaway.org. More exciting, but are the Olympics too dangerous and too extreme for your taste? Let us know.
Good morning. Actually, John Hockenberry is out all this week, so we have Todd Zwillick filling in for John. And we have the latest details coming out of Afghanistan. U.S., British, and Afghan forces have begun day three of the assault on the Taliban stronghold of Marja in Helmand province in the southern part of the country. For the latest details, we turn to Jean McKenzie. She's a correspondent for the Global Post in Kabul, Afghanistan, and she's been getting news from her reporters out in the field. Jean, what are the latest details on the offensive?
Well, we're hearing that the Taliban are winding down a bit on their defense, on their resistance, although the spokesperson is saying that the Taliban will resist to the end, that they're not going to let the foreign and Afghan forces into Marja. They obviously cannot hold out for very long against a force of 15,000 troops. But they have surrounded the area with mines. We're hearing up to 70,000 IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, have been laid in and around Marja, which is a fairly limited district. It's not a large area.
We've been hearing that the NATO and Afghan forces are moving very, very slowly. Is that because they're coming up against more IEDs than they expected?
Absolutely. We heard from one doctor inside Marja that just 200 meters in front of his house, he had seen the Taliban laying 35 mines that were interconnected. So that can do quite a bit of damage to a force that encounters them. They're going to have to move very, very slowly because with a very long run-up to this operation, the Taliban have had ample time to put down their weapons, to put down the IEDs.
Also with us this morning is Jeffrey Dressler. He's an expert on Afghanistan at the Institute for the Study of War. He focuses in particular on military strategy. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
I wanted you to listen to this particular clip of tape from Lieutenant Ryan Engel. He's with the Lima Company.
3-6, Lima Company. We came into the northwest area of Marja and took this intersection of the canals. It was limited resistance, much less, no real resistance, much less than was expected. But we did find several IEDs and bombs and things like that.
Why are we experiencing less resistance than expected in Marja?
Well, I actually don't think that it's a surprise to people who are familiar with the operations that the Taliban have mounted in the past. They typically do not confront a large-scale military force head-on. What they do is exactly what you're seeing. It's a lot of asymmetric hit-and-run attacks, primarily with IEDs and mines. And so this is really much, very much in character for what we've seen in the past. And I think that you know, as I heard you mention earlier, that certainly is going to account for the pace, the slow pace of the operation for the Marines and Afghan troops.
Jeffrey Dressler, 12 Afghan civilians were killed by an American rocket strike that missed its intended target yesterday. The whole purpose, the military had said, of publicizing this in advance was to, number one, get civilians to safe haven if they possibly could, and to allow the Taliban to cross over. So what does this rocket strike that killed 12 civilians, how does that hurt this offensive?
Well, I mean, there's no question that it's always a tragic event whenever innocent lives are lost. It's my understanding that what happened was it was a malfunction in the rocket technology that caused it to misfire and kind of go off target, and it struck a civilian compound. And I think the reports coming out are suggesting between 10 and 12 civilians were killed. And so, you know, obviously they've tried to do everything that they can to prevent civilian casualties, and that absolutely has been the number one concern, and I know that they'll continue to operate that way. Unfortunately, sometimes when you have that much combat power in a very small area, sometimes things like this can happen. But it's definitely going to be incumbent upon the tribal elders and the newly appointed district leaders who are going to go in shortly to explain to the population, okay, you know, here's what we're here to do. This is why we launched the operation, and we are here to bring you things that you want. And so hopefully they'll be understanding in that regard.
Jean McKenzie, have you heard any response from the, in terms of what the civilian response are to these casualties? I know that the United States has apologized to Hamid Karzai. What are the people of Afghanistan saying?
Well, of course, it's going to be a very angry reaction to this. No matter what the excuses are, you cannot expect that you're going to be able to conduct an operation of this size without civilian casualties. No matter how hard you try, accidents are going to happen. Bombs are going to land on the wrong houses, or rockets, as we see, have gone off course. But in addition to the outright civilian casualties, we've heard that up to 900 families, and that would be numbered in the thousands, 4,000 or 5,000 people, are now displaced. They're on the move. They're going to Las Cargas. They have no shelter. They have no food. This is also causing quite a negative reaction from the people of Helmand.
Jean McKenzie, this is Todd Zwillick here. What concern are you hearing from the troops if they're encountering light resistance at this point, that the Taliban have simply melted into Pakistan and will come back to fight another day when it's more advantageous for them?
I think, of course, that is a concern. They don't necessarily have to have melted into Pakistan. Much more likely, they are melting back into the population. It's very difficult to tell a Taliban from a farmer from a shopkeeper. So chances are that they will just lay down their arms. They will wait for things to calm down, and then they will start, as Jeffrey Dressler pointed out, asymmetric warfare against the troops once they have stopped the active offensive.
Jeffrey Dressler, I wanted to play for you this clip from NATO spokesman Mark Sedwill.
I can't yet say how long it will take for this military phase to get to the point where we can bring in the civilian support from the Afghan government. We hope that will happen quickly.
So we assume this offensive, as we said, is going to be slow and steady. But when it finishes, Janitor Stanley McChrystal said we're bringing in government in a box. Is that going to be the hardest part of this? Is what comes after they've secured the territory?
I think that's going to be really the marker of success here, not necessarily the military phase, but what these local governance elements, really the Afghan face that needs to be on this operation, come in and what they're able to accomplish. And so I think that we'll look to that over the coming months to see exactly how this thing's going to play out. The good news is we've done this before, even as recent as the past 6 to 9 months, and so we do have experience in that respect. So that's absolutely correct.
Jeffrey Dressler, he's an Afghanistan expert at the Institute for the Study of War. He focuses on military strategy, especially in Helmand Province, which is where the Marja offensive is going on now. Jean McKenzie is a correspondent for the Global Post. She joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Thanks to both of you.
The conversation continues at thetakeaway.org. Leave a comment now.
And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
We've just been talking about Afghanistan. Well, this morning, the government there called on Taliban fighters in the city of Marja to give up their weapons. Afghan Interior Minister Mohammad Atmar appealed to the Taliban to stop fighting.
The ones who are still remaining in the area, some of them have chosen to fight. Today, our message to them is your best option is to take advantage of the Afghan peace and reconciliation program.
Meanwhile, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, says she fears Iran is moving towards becoming what she called a military dictatorship. Mrs. Clinton said the international sanctions should target Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which she said was in effect supplanting government control. She was speaking on a tour of the Middle East. Off to space now, and astronauts on board the International Space Station have finished installing a new observation deck this morning. The installation has had its hiccups. Jammed bolts and loose wiring made for a long, frustrating night of work.
Every Roman Catholic bishop in Ireland will meet with the Pope one-on-one in the Vatican today about the years of sex abuse by the Irish clergy. Irish Bishop John Duffy says the Pope has been clued in for a long time.
Even before he became Pope at all, that he had access to the documentation, that he knew exactly what was in the documentation.
And back at home, Southwest Airlines has issued an apology to Hollywood director Kevin Smith. The airline officials threw him out of a flight because he was too large to fit in a single seat. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, who watches over the uninsured and the injured? We will. And we'll continue our series, The Waiting Room, and how some people are trying to find the bright side in a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for takeouts on the top stories that we're following all week. I'm Todd Zwillick, in all week for John Hockenberry, who's out. I'm here with Celeste, of course. First up, we turn to the White House, where President Obama plans to have an official meeting with the Dalai Lama in the map room in the White House. Now, in the world of diplomatic protocol, that's somehow less important than a meeting in the Oval Office. But the only problem is that a meeting with Tibet's spiritual leader is definitely going to enrage the Chinese just the same, regardless of which room of the White House it's in. And this is all at a time when the president really needs China's support. Well, here with more is Lynn Sweet. She's Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and columnist for AOL's Politics Daily. She's been following the story. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning.
Lynn, how long has this meeting been in the works? The Dalai Lama was in Washington a few months ago, right?
He was. He's been in the United States twice since Obama has been president. This visit Thursday will be his third time in the United States in the Obama presidency. The meeting has been in the works since September, when Obama sent senior advisor Valerie Jarrett over to Dalai Lama, India, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile. He's lived there since 1959, and on that September visit, she invited him to the United States.
So on the last visit, I remember the president did not meet with the Dalai Lama, and some human rights groups were upset about that. Now he is meeting with the Dalai Lama. The Chinese, of course, are outraged, but this all kind of smacks of sort of diplomatic theater. They knew this meeting was coming. Okay, China, you be outraged. We'll do our things. Let's not let anything derail. Am I reading too much into it?
Well, the timing is everything. One of the messages that the White House was sending to the Dalai Lama in September was that the meeting can take place after the president has been in China. So the China visit occurred in November. So that timeline, I think, speaks for itself. The Dalai Lama gets an invitation to the White House in September. He's in the United States in October, does not go to the White House. Then Obama goes to China in November, talks to the Chinese, explains his position, says that the relationship is can handle this, and the meeting is Thursday.
All very well choreographed so far. We'll see if the Chinese play their part later on in the week. Thank you, Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times and columnist for AOL's Politics Daily in Washington.
Our next takeout comes from the Olympic Village in Vancouver, British Columbia, where sports writer John Branch is covering the Olympic Games for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Can you kind of bring us up to speed on what happened with the Olympics over the weekend, both the tragic and the triumphant?
Sure. A couple of the storylines. First of all, the tragic is on the death of a luge athlete from Georgia on the luge track. And as he came to the very last corner of that track, was upended and went off the track and was killed. It's the first death of an athlete at the Olympics, of an athlete during training or at the competition itself since 1964. Certainly not the way the Olympics wanted to come off. Last night, a cheerier note for the Canadians and the Vancouver Organizing Committee was the first gold medal ever won by a Canadian on Canadian soil. This is the third Olympics for the Canadians to host. And last night, an athlete named Alex Bilodeau won a gold medal in moguls. So it'll be a big celebration.
Yeah, and probably a lot of people collecting on their office pools on when that was going to happen, right?
Exactly. And that has been being watched for several days now, the first few days of the Olympics. And he now will be a name that Canadians, I think, school children will never forget.
Okay, John Branch is a sports writer for our partner, the New York Times.
Now for our next takeout, we head to the waiting room.
I've never really thought about health plan until I got sick.
And suddenly I have some health problems.
A lot of people that need help like me. I'm not the only one.
The healthcare reform debate has gone relatively quiet in Washington, at least for now, as the White House and Democrats try to work out a new plan and make some nods of bipartisanship to Republicans. But far away from the halls of Congress, the conversation about what's right and what's wrong with healthcare rages on. We've been dropping in on those conversations regularly thanks to a project called The Waiting Room. It's a film and a web and social media project documenting life in the waiting room of Highland Hospital, which is a county facility in Oakland, California. First, we check in with Robert Templeton, who is with his family members at the hospital.
My daughter-in-law broke her foot, and I took off of work to bring her here. She does not have health insurance. Her foot is broken, and she's still sitting there waiting. And there's another lady in a wheelchair over there who's been here since we've been here, over an hour and a half, and you can see the pain on her face, and she's not being waited on.
This project also features moments of beauty in a place where people are often experiencing misery and boredom or impatience. Here's Wanda Gorey, a housekeeper at Highland Hospital. She says faith has helped her enjoy her job. In this moment, she decided to sing to the waiting patients.
Why should I feel discouraged? And why should the shadows
You can watch videos of the waiting room and learn more about the project at thetakeaway.org. And of course, we always want to hear about your experiences with doctors and hospitals as the health reform debate rages on. That's also at thetakeaway.org. You know, Celeste, I cover this debate in Washington, and as much as it rages on, the people I cover really probably don't have a sense, a true sense of what people go through in the waiting room trying to get care for that broken leg when they don't have insurance or that child who's sick.
And I think that's part of the issue, is trying to help the people in Washington understand what it's like on the ground. Also, understanding what it's like on the ground, we're going to talk later about family, as we do every Monday. And we're going to talk about, how does your family make sense of autism when it seems like health studies contradict themselves? We have the straight facts for you later this hour. We're also following the Winter Olympics all morning long. Got off to kind of a sad start, as we talked about, when a loser died during practice on Friday. And we're looking for your takeaway. Are the Winter Olympics getting too fast? Are they too extreme? Are they trying to get audience members by being too extreme? Are they too dangerous? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to the website, thetakeaway.org.
How do you go down market in terms of age without making it so dangerous that it's bad for the athletes? You know, coming up, we're also going to talk about what to expect from the week's news. It's Monday. It's The Agenda with the New York Times and the BBC. It's in a few minutes. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry all this week. Coming up, we take a look at the week ahead in news. That's a check on the agenda in just a few minutes. Right now, let's check on some top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. The battle for Marja is in day three in Afghanistan.
Clear as many compounds as possible and push up.
NATO troops now have most of the city under control. A remaining problem is the thousands of mines and IEDs the Taliban has hidden throughout the city that makes for slow going for U.S. troops, with one report saying it takes 9 hours to clear a single mile there. And this morning, we're learning a large number of Taliban fighters have fled the city. That's according to Afghan Interior Minister, who says a small number of fighters have stayed behind. Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, tells CBS News the Marja campaign could not be seen as a turning point in the war.
We will do well militarily, but whether we can translate this into enduring security and stability gains, we won't know that for years.
So far, one U.S. Marine has been killed in the fighting.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Iran is moving towards a military dictatorship. Speaking in Qatar this morning, she says Iran's Revolutionary Guard, which already controls the nuclear program, is now seizing key positions throughout the government. And the International Space Station has a new addition, a $27 million observation deck. Astronauts successfully attached it after a long night spent in spacewalks. Let's check on the markets. Asian markets are down, but European indices are up. Wall Street markets are closed for the President's Day holiday today. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Issues that are of mutual interest.
Criminal acts as opposed to acts of war.
Working through questions.
Carrying forward this important work.
It's Monday morning, and that means it's time to check out what's on for the week ahead. It's The Agenda. We do it every Monday. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton continues her trip in the Middle East this week. She spoke today at the U.S. Islamic World Forum and had very strong words for the Iranian government. She says that they've been becoming a military dictatorship. Listen to this.
I fear that the rise of influence and power by the Revolutionary Guard poses a very direct threat to everyone.
Secretary of State also threatened greater costs to the Iranian regime if it does not comply with nuclear inspections and U.S. desires for their nuclear program. To discuss this and other items on our agenda, we were joined earlier this morning by Rob Watson, political correspondent for our partner, the BBC, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. We started by asking Marcus if the statements by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton were meant to isolate Iran, to strengthen ties with the rest of the Muslim world, or some combination of both?
It's actually both. It's interesting that what she really is at risk of this week, and it's not just the Secretary of State who's at risk, but even the President as he meets with the Dalai Lama, and we'll talk about later on, the administration is at risk this week of kind of highlighting American impotence in the world. And the fact that even though it's been a year since President Obama came to office with great hopes for foreign policy, we actually have not seen a great deal of progress on any of these really important fronts. And even in Afghanistan, we're seeing this is the most serious offensive we've ever had in Afghanistan. Afghanistan this week in 8 years of war. So this, too, is a test of the administration's ability to change facts on the ground in a way that the previous administration never did. And that's what we're going to see in the Middle East this week with Secretary of State Clinton. The fact is, Iran, it's a military dictatorship, as she's declared. Well, what are we going to do about that? And it's not clear we can do a whole lot. When she talks about the cost, greater cost, she's talking about an increased sanctions. And it's not even clear we can get that. And so that's the enjeu here is really the administration look a little stronger and a little more effective than they have in the past.
Rob Watson of the BBC, Marcus Mabry suggests that the time is ripe for some tough talk from the administration. It seems that Secretary Clinton talking about a military dictatorship in Iran is tailor-made for the Saudis, who are traditional enemies of the Iranians.
Absolutely, although I'm going to disappoint everyone by rather boringly agreeing with Marcus 100%.
Oh, hey, why not?
This does really sort of show up the impotence, if you like, or potentially the impotence. But I guess I'd want to see it as another way. You know, I remember there were lots of people around, certainly around Europe and some in the Middle East, who thought, phewie, thank goodness George W. Bush has gone. Now we can get on with solving some of these dreadful problems. And you get to see that the real issue that's out there is not so much who's in the White House, but just that there are an awful lot of problems that are very, very difficult to deal with, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or whoever you are. And this really reinforces it, and specifically on Saudi Arabia. Look, lots of Iran's neighbors realize that it's a threat. Lots of them were just dying for the nuclear issue to go away. But when you actually confront them and say, what are you going to do about it? Well, then you get the difficulties.
Rob Watson of the BBC, you mentioned the White House, and I want to move on to China, if we could, and the international sort of reaction to the president meeting with the Dalai Lama, specifically the Chinese. Now, this visit, the president going to be meeting with the Dalai Lama in the White House later this week, has been planned for a long time. Of course, the Chinese outrage is mounting right on cue. It's hard to imagine that this is a surprise for anyone. So how should we interpret the president's meeting with the Dalai Lama and the Chinese outrage over said meeting on the international stage?
Well, as you say, it's pretty much according to script, isn't it? Look, in international terms, the way countries like Britain and others in the European Union see it, that they're cutting Obama some slack here because they think, okay, you know, he's tried what everyone wanted him to do. Let's try being a bit nice to China. Let's try being a bit nice to North Korea and Iran. And let's try pressing the reset button with Russia. The very fact that he's tried those things and doesn't seem to have got a huge amount to date out of it means that everyone's right back on the script. Okay, well, you've got to see the Dalai Lama. You've got to do other things. You've got to be tough on Iran.
All right. Well, let's listen to Press Secretary Robert Gibbs talking about this very issue earlier this week.
We can agree on issues that are of mutual interest, but we also have a mature enough relationship that we know that two countries on this planet are not always going to agree on everything, and we'll have those disagreements.
Okay, Marcus Mabry, the dynamic of poking China with the stick a little bit when you have to over the Dalai Lama is clear. But what does the president have to gain, do you think, from holding this meeting? Why does he feel he has to do it?
Well, he has to do it because he has to show that the United States still cares, although we care most of all, and it's increasingly clear in our relationship with China about our economic relationship with China, which is a mutually assured destruction, some would say, but certainly a mutually beneficial relationship. They take our debt when no one else. They take it in great quantities, and we take their product. They're still export-dependent economy. We take their product. So that's the most important thing about the relationship between these two countries. At the same time, the president of the United States, especially a Democratic president, especially given how much the Republican president before him did this, must underline how much the United States continues to care about the rights of minorities and religious minorities.
He has a political debate that demands this.
Absolutely. There's no other choice. Again, the last administration did so much in this regard, criticizing China on these issues, that he can't do any less.
All right, Marcus Mabry in the New York Times, I have to get your take on this little battle that's going, the battle of the vice presidents, Dick Cheney and the current vice president, Joe Biden, going at each other on the Sunday shows on terrorism. Let's give Dick Cheney his say first.
It's the mindset that concerns me, John. I think it's very important to go back and keep in mind the distinction between handling these events as criminal acts, which is the way we did before 9/11, and then looking at 9/11 and saying this is not a criminal act, not when you destroy 16 acres of Manhattan, kill 3,000 Americans, blow a big hole in the Pentagon. That's an act of war.
All right. Now, the vice president shot back and said that Dick Cheney's trying to be entitled to his own facts.
Dick Cheney's a fine fella, but he is not entitled to rewrite history without it being challenged. I don't know where he has been. Where was he the last 4 years, the last administration?
That was Vice President Joe Biden on NBC's Meet the Press responding to former Vice President Dick Cheney, who appeared on ABC's This Week. What do you make of that battle, Marcus?
Well, this is exactly the same criticism that the Republicans made against John Kerry when he was running against George W. Bush. The Democrats see it as a legal battle. The Republicans see it as an act of war. There's not a whole lot to it other than the politics and the rhetoric that Cheney's pursuing, but the Republicans have had some success with it in the past.
That was Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and Rob Watson, BBC correspondent, who joined us from Bush House in London. Coming up, we talk about family life every Monday. Now, how do you and your family make sense of autism when it seems like health studies contradict themselves and autism itself is so very complicated? We talk about that issue coming up later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Investigators are looking into the past of a biology professor accused of killing three of her colleagues at the University of Alabama on Friday. Amy Bishop was charged on Saturday with the shootings. It's now being reported that Bishop may also have murdered her brother 24 years ago in a shooting at their home outside Boston. And she was a suspect in a mail bombing of a Harvard Medical School professor in 1993. We're joined now by New York Times reporter Shyla Dewan. She's covering the story from Huntsville, Alabama. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
So can you give us more details about what they've discovered in terms of the shooting of both her brother, in which he was killed in their home with a shotgun, and this mail bombing of a Harvard Medical School professor?
Sure. I mean, new details keep coming out, and you just don't know whether this woman was incredibly unlucky or whether she has a violent history. In 1986, a shotgun went off in her house, killing her brother. She had the shotgun, but it's not clear whether she and her brother were arguing. As some of the police who were there at the time now say, or if it was purely accidental, and she was asking for help with the shotgun, which is what the police reports and the district attorney's investigation say.
Well, they had details in which they said she then shot off the shotgun again and then went running down the street and threatened a driver of a car to let her into the car with the gun.
That's right, but that's one story.
That's alleged.
But that story, so far, we don't know if there's any records that show that chain of events happening, because the records that have been released so far do not indicate
some of the cases missing. Are there any inklings that they may reopen the case of the death of her brother, Seth Bishop?
I think what they're doing first is they're trying to see if they can find that earlier police report that is missing.
The original police report.
And then they're going to go from there.
So what about this mail bombing of the Harvard Medical School professor in 1993?
Well, we just learned yesterday that she and her husband were questioned in that case. The Boston Globe reported that she was a significant suspect in the case, that authorities knew that she had killed her brother, and they were worried because she apparently had some cause to be concerned that this doctor was going to give her a bad evaluation. She was also considered strange or weird by her colleagues there at the hospital, and so the police questioned her, but it's important to say again that no one was ever charged in the case.
And we've gotten a little bit more of a complete ideas on what possible motivation she may have had in the shootings on Friday. Do we know what might have triggered it?
Well, we got clarification yesterday from her husband that her tenure decision was denied by the university, that she won her appeal, and then the university, which can do this, denied her again.
Okay, so it could have been the possibility that she was reaching the end of her 6 years at the university and therefore was going to lose her job.
That's right.
Shyla Dewan is a reporter with the New York Times. She is covering the story of the shootings that happened on Friday. She's covering that from Huntsville, Alabama. A biology professor at the University of Alabama opened fire at a faculty meeting at the university there and has killed three of her colleagues. Allegedly, she has been charged with the shooting. She was charged on Saturday. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm joined by Todd Zwillick this morning, who's filling in for John Hockenberry this week. When health studies contradict each other, who do you believe? How do you know what to believe when it comes down to science and medical issues? We're going to focus on autism today and how to separate fact from fiction. It's coming up in a minute. First, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. As we've been talking about all morning long, today is the third day of the major military offensive in the city of Marja in Afghanistan. Latest reports from our partner, the BBC, say the U.S. advance is being slowed down by Taliban snipers and by the discovery of far more IEDs or improvised explosive devices than expected. There's been a major train crash in Belgium today. The Associated Press says at least 25 people are known to have been killed in the rush hour collision of two commuter trains in Brussels. There are reports one of the trains went through a red light.
At the Winter Olympics, Canada's long cold streak finally ended. Alexander Bilodeau took home gold in the moguls, winning Canada's first ever Olympic gold on their home turf.
There will be more gold winning, and I'll be in the stands here for them.
Okay, he's confident. So far, the U.S. leads the medal count with six, followed by Germany and then France.
Today in international business, ticket prices for transatlantic flights could be affected by a newly approved alliance between American Airlines, British Airways, and Iberia Airlines. The U.S. Department of Transportation has given the One World Alliance antitrust immunity. For details on this, we spoke earlier this morning with BBC business reporter Rodney Smith. He told us how the deal stands and how it would affect ticket prices on something like a one-way flight from New York to London.
Well, first of all, the deal's quite a long way away yet. It's not happened, and the Europeans still have to decide if they're going to go ahead with this. But you're quite right. The whole point really is about the effect that it has on people flying between New York-London or New York-Paris or whatever, from between the States and between Europe. And at the moment, it's unlikely to have an impact. But over time, say the airlines, there will be economies of scale which will allow costs to come down. But critics say, of course, that that's all very well, but there could have been nine airlines here instead of what we're seeing now, which is essentially three alliances, and that means the competition is less, and so prices could be higher.
So they've given this One World Alliance antitrust immunity. Is this something that consumers should be outraged about?
They didn't give antitrust immunity 10 years ago when it was first applied for, so we have to wonder what happened in the interim. They've required that BA give up some of the these very lucrative airline slots at Heathrow. That's right, British Airways. They're having to give up four slots. This is a very technical issue, and you have to wonder what sort of pressure was put on the regulators that they decided to let this come through like this.
Okay, Rodney Smith is the business reporter for our partner, the BBC. He joined us from London. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
New studies are released and retracted all the time on what causes autistic spectrum disorder and what quote-unquote cures it. For example, in the last 2 weeks, the British medical journal The Lancet retracted the frequently cited Wakefield study from 1998, which linked MMR vaccine, that's measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, to autism. Now, just a few days later, the journal Autism Research published a study saying that advanced maternal and paternal age, that's the age of mom and dad, is a risk factor for autism. So what's true and what isn't? We want to spend a little time trying to get down into the data on autism. To make it a little simpler, we want to give you a little bit of a crib sheet here on what we know about autism and what we don't know. Dr. Perry Klass and Dr. Eileen Costello are both pediatricians and co-authors of Quirky Kids. Dr. Klass is here in the studio with me. Dr. Klass, autistic spectrum disorder is sort of the catch-all phrase. And the term autism is really hard to understand because it's not just one thing. It may not even be just five things. Can you help us understand exactly what is autism in a way that isn't too overwhelming to even understand for us?
Well, it's a complicated term, it's a complicated spectrum, and I think one of the things that you bring up in what you said initially is just our understanding that it is a spectrum, that it's not one very specific disorder, that it's a whole spectrum of behaviors and levels of function. That's kind of new. That wasn't around when wasn't around when I was in medical school, let alone when I was a child.
Characterized by what? A couple of instances of the behaviors or the problems that identify this.
There is a communication issue, both a social communication issue in terms of understanding other people's social cues and social signals. There can be very specific communication considerations in terms of how children use speech and language and how language develops. There is a whole range of issues then that come up around repetitive acts and very special interests and even obsessional interests. There's an interplay of these different traits that mark people on the autism spectrum. I just want to comment on one other thing before you say. You say new studies are introduced and retracted all the time. In fact, that retraction that you mentioned by The Lancet was a pretty unusual event and probably has something to do with why we're having this conversation.
Probably does. Well, all of these behaviors and these difficulties that kids have that you're describing, as complicated as they are, all translate to really difficult parenting. Or they can, because these kids can be difficult to parent. Dr. Costello, I want to bring you in. I have a list in front of me of a lot of causes or supposed causes of autism. We've heard all of these, but they're really complicated. And I thought you might go down the list and just help us understand how much of this is true. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right. Vaccines. They're definitely off the table as a cause now?
Yes.
Off the table.
And that is a wonderful thing. As a primary care pediatrician, I think the Wakefield study that Dr. Klass was just referring to really caused a lot of fear and panic around the world and caused a lot of parents to have anxiety about immunizing their children. And it's a real blessing that the paper was retracted, because I think that research dollars were diverted in order to disprove that theory that could have been used for more important things.
Okay, let's get down the list here a little bit. Vaccines off the table. Environmental factors, heavy metals like lead and mercury.
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think the mercury question is also a vaccine question, because I think when the MMR vaccine came off the table, the idea that something in vaccines must be causing this problem gained some strength. And I think we're pretty clear that it's certainly not the mercury-based preservatives in vaccines. And even the children who are exposed to very high levels of mercury don't actually manifest autistic symptoms.
Okay,
I think we're pretty sure that's not the problem either.
Okay, I don't want to keep you too short, but we have a long list and there's so many questions about this. Viruses that can affect pregnant women, like influenza and herpes, do they have a role?
There is some data to suggest that viral infections in pregnancy can increase your rates of developmental disorders, including autism.
Now, we had this study last week that we mentioned, age of mom and dad, older age increases your risk. What do we know about that?
Yes, I think that theory's been around for a long time, and there is growing data that advanced parental age is a risk factor.
Okay, that it could be. Dr. Klass, we've talked about some of the causes of autism. What about cures, or so-called cures? We've heard about gluten-free and dairy-free diets. A lot of this stuff seems to be trial and error.
A lot of this stuff is trial and error, and when you talk about the burdens that autism places on parents, some of these more extreme diets place an even greater burden on parents. Obviously, different things parents feel help with different children. The idea of a cure for autism is not really something we talk about. We talk about this as whether the child gets relief or help with the things that get in the way, with the things that make that child's life difficult. And there's no evidence around those diets, especially the more extreme diets.
So you're talking about behavioral help and help with the difficulties of behavior and parenting, not necessarily high-dose vitamins or things like chelation therapy, which is where they go in and try to suck the lead and the mercury out.
And which is actually dangerous and
which
has been known to kill a child. No, we're talking
oxygen chambers and things like that.
I think the really basic message, and I bet Dr. Costello would agree with me about this, is that the behavioral therapies, and especially when you start them early, the more intense behavioral therapies are showing up as really effective. And for that, there really are data. And therefore, that urge to get children looked at and diagnosed earlier rather than later and get them help early is where a lot of our attention and effort should be going.
All right. So we're talking about paying attention to behavior and helping with the difficult behaviors of autism rather than some chemical interventions. That's Dr. Perry Klass, primary care pediatrician and Science Times writer. And we're also joined by Dr. Eileen Costello, primary care pediatrician and co-author of Quirky Kids. And we'll have more info for you on the website, where we explain the 5 myths about autism. That's at thetakeaway.org.
You can also follow more of our stories all week long with our podcast. You can listen on demand and even get a preview of the next day's show. That's all on our website, thetakeaway.org. We've been talking about dogs, actually, this week, because the Westminster Dog Show begins today. One of the things we're discussing today is whether or not we're too obsessed with our pets and whether that's healthy for both us and our dogs. Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do you think? Post a comment at thetakeaway.org. That's also the website is where you can post a photo of your dog. You have an hour left until 10 a.m. Eastern to get a picture of your dog up on thetakeaway.org, because we're going to have our own little dog show, including Best in Show and some other prizes. They're all going to go to my beagle, of course.
Right.
Give us your picture at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.